So this is another one of these interviews, conversations, couch sessions, whatever you want to call it, with someone who I have great respect and admiration for, and yet I'm not sure what they do. I'm just really a big fan of all the things that they do. And I have to start kind of with a preface here and a full disclosure. I've been behind the scenes to some degree on the work that Hillary Ramo has done, starting in radio and with her books. But that's just like the tip of the iceberg. I've got to see behind here a little bit of way this moves and how it works. But there are still questions that I have. And when I line people up to be guests on this show, I'm pretty selective on who I spend time with, because time is a very precious commodity and I don't want to waste anybody's time. So I'm always digging into the, you know, the going up the down staircase and in the outdoor and trying to find the obvious buried in the absurd. And I like to connect with people who do the same thing. So Hillary is joining me today. Now, where are you? Are you in upstate New York?
Hi, John. Yeah, I'm in Altamont, New York. It's
Altamont.
Upstate.
Yeah.
Close to Albany, the capital of New York, yes.
Yeah. So let's rewind, because I need a refresher course. How did we meet exactly? Because it's a long time ago.
I interviewed you in my first year on the radio back in 2005.
Oh, my gosh.
And actually, no, it was 2008, because before that, we had the same agent, Ginny Weissman. We were working with Ginny.
Yeah.
And Ginny introduced us, and it just kind of grew from there. And then I interviewed you and did a horrible job the first time I interviewed you. I was so nervous.
Well, we have clips of that.
I was so nervous.
We have clips of that show. Hold on. Let's get... No, we don't. No.
Oh, no, you have clips of it.
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to play that. I was getting ready. Well, it was the introduction. I botched it so bad I had to actually go back and re-record it, because I was like, oh, my God, he's coming from Oprahland. Mm. Who am I to interview this guy? So, and then we did it a few more shows over the years, and I got better and better, so it was good.
You know, you were my first. I had never done a Skype interview until about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And so much of this stuff to me, you know, it's emerging platforms and all the things that, you know, people like to talk about and how to get the word out and communicate. I just have never found, every time I thought about Skype, I think about what somebody looks like when they look through the keyhole, right? The little peephole thing, and everybody's face looks like five times bigger. But you're the only person that I said, sure, I'll do it. And I actually had just moved into the house we're in now. I didn't have Skype set up. So I went to a library nearby, walked over to the library. They set me up. And I did this Skype interview with you. And it's the only one I've ever done. So there you go. You get the award.
I get the first Skype interview award. That's amazing. That was actually a guest spot that I was doing on Capricorn Radio in Ireland. Mm. And I was helping to produce a few shows on that network and meeting one of our guests. And it was fun. Mm. I thought so. It was nice to see you on video and also hear your voice. It was. And Skype always has a way of freezing in that awkward face position, just like YouTube videos. You know, you're talking, you're halfway through saying something, and you look like your lip is attached. Not you personally, but most people
have
that ugly resting face.
Yeah. And this is what I love. I am such a traditionalist when it comes to radio, even though this is a podcast. It's just a name, just a title, just a file label somewhere. To me, this is the essence of it. You know, it was Longfellow who said that the human voice is the organ of the soul. And I think it's how you use the voice really matters most. And for all the years that I've known you and the work that you've done in radio on various different platforms, you mentioned Capricorn, you've done a bunch of others, that's really seems to be, in my opinion, even though you've written three books and you're an incredible photographer and artist and all the things that you do, that to me has always been your calling card, this voice thing. Where was the impetus for you to even get in this direction? What was the catalyst?
Well, I went to Egypt in 2005, and I had a very life-changing trip there, experiencing all that Egypt offers as far as ruins and place and time, and just really was affected by it. So when I came back, somebody had asked if they could interview me on my journey. So, of course, I said, sure, but I had never done radio before. So, of course, it was brand new. And I really enjoyed being able to speak without being on video. I think when people go on to video, their focus changes a little bit, and they're more concerned sometimes about how they look on video. And it just creates a different atmosphere. So I was really happy with how radio gave me an ability to just kind of sit there and stare off into the ethers and pull memories out of my brain and be able to talk freely without that hassle. And so they liked, I guess they did a pretty good job because they asked me to come on to their station and do my own show. And of course I said no first. So I went on a couple more guest spots, I think within the few, 3 months or so. And then I decided I would give it a shot. So I started to broadcast on that platform, and I liked it. And then there was a local station here at Terrestrial Radio. They had heard a couple of my shows, and I was approached by a producer who wanted to help me put together some shows for the local AM talk radio here in upstate New York. So I did that for 3 years. And then in 2008, I officially started on Achieve Radio, where I stayed until 2017. But I did go off and co-produce and help do a couple other things on different networks along the way. I worked for BBS Radio. I worked for CCN in London, Capricorn in Ireland. So I spread myself out a little bit and got a taste of what it was like to work with different companies and different networks, and got a really good look behind the scenes. Some ran better than others. And it was quite a learning experience, actually.
So back before all of that, which was really comprehensive and very well said, by the way, before that, is this something you always thought you'd be doing? I mean, even before you had the trip to Egypt, what in your background kind of pulled you even in that direction? How was it when you grew up, and what was some of the things that maybe pushed you in that direction?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with my spiritual path, because I kind of tend to do things backwards, and I don't do that intentionally. It's like I go and have my spiritual awakening early on in my life, and then I get a real job kind of thing. So I put time and money and effort into a career after I've already done a lot of the spiritual work. My grandfather was a huge influence in my life. His name was Les Holloway, and he, before the age of the internet, was a very well-known psychic, and he used to work with some pretty big people, and he was very influential in my life as far as introducing me to the alternative space, I like to call it, and being able to reach into that space and understand it and develop a relationship with it. So he taught me how to read his tarot cards before he died. He died on his 70th birthday. My son had just been born that year, and he was able to meet him before he died. We all went down for a family party, and he passed over his deck to me. He died a week later. And so I think that what happened with me was that because I had worked with him young, I did a past life regression with him when I was 5, and it was quite by accident. It wasn't anything planned. And it opened up my mind to the awareness of something else. And something else exists besides what I just see here right in front of me kind of thing. And for 5 years old, it's a lot like imagination. You know, you can imagine anything. Mm-hmm. You can play anything, right? So it wasn't too out of sorts. But as I got older into my teenage years, it was a little bit more difficult to navigate that connection to that alternative space when you're a teenager and you're trying to fit in and you're trying, you know, you have all these social situations that you're presented with through high school that can be sometimes challenging for a normal person, but even more so for someone who's connected to that other space and has a good relationship with it. So right. I went through some turbulence through that. And when I became a young adult, before I had my kids, I decided that I needed to explore these things. And once you're out of school, it's kind of like you have the opportunity to actually look and research and do the things that you really want to do, where you don't have to follow somebody's syllabus or what you're mandated to do. So I had the freedom to do that. And then I had my kids, and I still continued to do it. And I traveled, and I opened up a lot of that connection even more. And I was really looking and actively seeking for that spiritual learning. So I had a few teachers through that phase of my life. And radio ended up becoming a way to manifest an act of power in the world. And by that, I mean manifest a channel or an activity or build something that has a meaning and intent behind it. So when I manifest anything, I always think first about, well, what's the intent? You know, is the intent to get my name out there and be popular and famous? No. Is the intent to help give information to listeners and people who care about learning new things? Yes. And so what I did was I started the radio because actually I had also read through all of David Icke's work on the prompt of Lynn Andrews, who was a New York Times bestselling author. She had written 19, 20 books.
Right.
And I was working with her closely, and she said, oh, you have to go read David Icke and everything he's ever written. And I said, why? So I picked up the first book and almost cried because it was horrible, and it was very difficult information. But because I was prompted to do it by someone I had great respect for at the time, I got through it all. And then on the other end of it, I read nothing for a year or so based on that. Went to Egypt. And then I came back and I said, you know, it is about information. It's about knowing and understanding that there are other storylines or perspectives or opinions or even facts that are not necessarily always included in the official story that we're given. So I was kind of circumnavigating that at that point in my life. And I had just kind of had my psyche blown open with David's work and really didn't know what to do with it all, because I wanted to run out and tell everybody, did you know this? Did you know
that? Right.
Just look at this. Look at what he says. You know, and some of it's quite extraordinary way out there. But because, because I had been told to read it, I pushed myself through it and actually went to see him speak on the West Coast once when he came to the States. And I was mesmerized by his character because he was able to speak for 8 hours with only a 15-minute break. Hmm. And he was charismatic. He was, you know, really passionate about the material he was delivering. And so to see him speak live and kind of off the cuff, he didn't have any notes or really anything in front of him prompting him. He was really in it, was quite changing. And I think that's what kind of started it. It was an impetus. The impetus was we were starting to begin a decade where we hadn't been introduced to social media yet. We hadn't been introduced to cryptocurrency yet. Mm-hmm. We hadn't really been moved into a different direction for what I call the digital age. It was kind of pre-digital age-ish, where it was like the wild, wild west, where you could produce content and put it on the internet and have lots and lots of exposure because of it, thanks to the freedom of that. But now, you know, at the other end of my career, you know, a couple decades later, I see that a lot of that's been reined in. So I'm glad I was able to be a part of that free-flowing content, reviewing, helping people understand alternative health, alternative history. This was before Ancient Aliens. I've interviewed probably 99% of the Ancient Aliens staff, pre-Ancient Aliens.
Right.
So, I mean, I was talking to people who were talking about pyramid cultures, matriarchal cultures, holistic healing, like with Reiki and things like that, before it had become a household, who cares, everybody sees it, everybody knows it, History Channel, you know, Saga at 9 o'clock, right? So I was really digging into a lot of these places and helping to produce content on YouTube and online and sending them out to my I had a lot of followers at that time. For a few years, I was the number one show on Achieve Radio Network, because I was talking about things most people weren't talking about yet. And then it exploded and it was considered alternative media because we offered alternative perspectives and information for people to dig through and digest. So that was the impetus. And that's kind of an overall look at my career on radio and where I started and what kind of spurred me on.
One of the things that And watching your career these years and watching the materials that you produce from that, the way that you deliver the information and the conversations you've had with people. And I find it fascinating that the, quote, digital age, I don't know exactly where we're at and all that. I have a friend of mine. See, I'm not a huge fan. I'm basically a stegosaurus. You know, my time was over a long time ago. I'm still just dragging my ass until I fall into the La Brea tar pit of radio. But as I keep learning this along the way, I had a friend of mine not too long ago tell me, he says, you know, I still have hope for humanity, as unsocial as media appears to be, as we learn to, you know, use it in ways that are for our benefit, not so much just to pick on each other. And to me, you know, when you squeeze a bunch of people together, you never know what kind of shit's going to come out. And digital media, digital technologies have squeezed humans together in a way we never have before. But every time I turn to the information that you produce, you use the digital media to have these conversations long form, not 9 seconds, not 2 minutes, long form, so people could really dig into them. And over a period of time, I can see why you'd be the number one show on Achieve with the kind of conversations that you had. So jumping over to something that, was within the last 36, 48 months was the whole thing that I watched your take on, which is Alex Jones, who is a guy that has used that, quote, alternative platform, alternative media, alternative information space to move things around that more than likely would never have moved around had he not been there. And I've watched your take on this, and I've, for the most part, I just kind of watch. I don't say a whole lot. I just kind of watch because I'm not an aficionado of it as you are. I'm not an expert in it as you are. And using him as an example, I mean, on one hand, we have what you did, which is really raise people's vibration. The conversations with, you know, Dr. Judy Wood and Stephen Greer and Phil Corso Jr. and, you know, the whole Tom Campbell, Lynn Andrews, as you mentioned, great stuff and really highly important and impactful for people as far as upping their vibration in the world, which is a difficult place to begin with. And then if you take that on one end and you take what Alex Jones, for the most part, puts out, which is in a, my observation, a different direction, somewhere in the middle, we're still trying to figure these things out. How do you see this playing field, which is so broad and so vast and so deep, as we keep moving forward?
Well, in 2016, I was writing a book proposal for Cambridge University's Nine Dot Prize. And they come out with this every 2 years, and they ask one question, and everybody has to submit a book proposal based on this one question. And that year, they had asked how technologies were making politics as usual impossible. So I took that on, and I wrote a full-blown book proposal for Cambridge that year. And I was also hosting a political podcast. Somebody had asked me to come on to be the host for that. So I was interviewing, people who were in key positions in industry, agriculture, and then some of the Libertarian Party people and so on and so forth. So I was kind of immersed in that year. Well, that year also, Trump went on to Alex Jones's show to do an interview, which during an active presidential campaign is very rare to see anybody go on to anyone who's not CNN, NBC, CBS, right, all right. the big players, right? So that caught my attention. And when I said, you know, it's very odd that he went on to Alex Jones, but yet it's not, right? Because here's why. So at the time Alex Jones and I were growing through, the early 2000s to mid-2000s, we were kind of doing, like you said, similar content, but we both had way different deliveries.
Sure.
And Alex always took on the rah-rah, you know, the angry spectator, you know, let's rile up the crowd and that kind of thing. And I was a little more delicate in my conversations and a little more purposeful. So at one point, we were discussing me coming on Alex's his show. I was in communication with his producers. And they wanted me to come on, and I had told them that I wanted to talk about, yes, the political platforms, the things that are going on, but I also want to talk about the symbolism in some of the corporate places, and I wanted to talk about some of the deeper symbolic, maybe even spiritual stuff that was going on behind the scenes as well, and they canceled all communication from that point. They stopped the show production after I said that.
Yes.
Which I said, oh, well, okay, fine.
Right.
And I picked myself up and kept going. But what I noticed about Alex Jones was not only did he have the highest ratings when it came to alternative media shows, he was also on many different networks. He actually was on KCAA, which I broadcast on now, which is an NBC News affiliate station in Southern California. So they air terrestrial radio around Los Angeles and Southern California. So he was there for, I think, 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And who's funding this? Because you have to buy your own airtime.
Right.
And I know you have to buy your own airtime. So when I talked to the network owner, Fred Lundgren, he was like, well, you know, Alex was here, and he was working with some of their bigger producers, and who was funding that? So he must have either taken a second mortgage out on his house,
mm-hmm.
probably why his wife divorced him years later. But he was also on hundreds of other networks as well. So I started to dig, because that's my nature, and I started to look into it more and more. And when his platform started to be dissected over the last year and a half or so, it was broadcasted on Nightly News, NBC Nightly News, which is very difficult to get a story on there, but there he was. And they were taking the angle of him being this anti-Sandy Hook, you know, how dare he even mention that it was a possible false flag and we were manipulated through it because this person lost their child and they sued him. And then they took all of his stuff off YouTube. They took his stuff off Facebook. They took him down on Twitter. And what I saw was almost like an intentional shredding and deleting and censorship and removal of content. And they were using Alex as an example to take down the, quote, conspiratorial media that had really gained a strong footage in the third decade of the Internet. Mm-hmm. So in 2019, we're entering the fourth decade of the Internet, and one of Google execs have even gone on C-SPAN to talk about how the third decade, which was when we were all really kind of going at it with all this information, was the Wild Wild West. And now the fourth decade is going to be the reigning in. So he went on this public platform on C-SPAN, and this Google exec was talking about how their agenda now really is reigning in content, which is AKA censorship, right? Mm-hmm. And how they want the online platforms to be more controllable, and they've used the fake news stuff to go after it. They used Alex Jones as an example, who, oh, by the way, broadcasts. He's a big Trump supporter on his show, and he's really just become a giant cheerleader for Trump. Mm-hmm. So he's gone away, I guess, from the New World Order stuff, and he still might talk about it here and there. But for many years, he was talking about this large conspiracy of corporatocracy taking over and people losing their rights and all this stuff. So I think that ideally what the people behind the curtain want for the Internet is one official story, one official news, you know, official news outlet. They don't want anybody else like me broadcasting or Alex broadcasting. They want to really rein in or just kind of shadow censor people so that they don't get the views, they don't get the likes, they don't get the attention that they used to get online. I know my stats have dropped dramatically over since 2011 when I first started getting red flagged on YouTube and my content was being removed from YouTube because it was considered editorial, so they didn't like what we were talking about, which I just made me do it more. So I did it more and produced more and more content and even started my own content producing company for a few years. And then I just started to realize that it was like running in place, and you really have a hard time as one person without a huge financial backing to be able to make a dent in what they're creating now for content producing. So I just let it go and figured, well, whoever will find my material will find my material. And it's what prompted my third book, which was taking some of the 20 conversations over the years of my career, putting them into print, owning the copyrights to that. So it's like a slice of time and information that people can read and say, well, I never heard this, or maybe I did. But actual conversations that took place through this very turbulent and transformational and defining age, which I think we've all just lived through, and now we're watching some of that, some interesting coordinations by different entities move it into something that's more controllable.
Let me just jump back real quick without making this a billboard one way or the other for whatever Alex Jones does or doesn't do, but more as an example. Then I want to go back to the book here, because that's to me where the meat of all this is. But my question to you is, someone who has a microphone, has a platform, has had one for going on, what, 11 years now, 12 years now? Is there a responsibility?
Yeah, 15. 15 years. 15, actually, yeah.
I don't know, you'd correct me, because it's all good. you know, I grew up in a day and age where you turn on the television and Mr. Rogers would be there saying, hello, kids, good morning, you know, let's all be nice to each other and that kind of thing, which is fine. I still don't see Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers. I can't watch that kind of stuff. I saw the real Mr. Rogers. I don't want to see Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers, but I digress. Is there Mr. Rogers used to say that the space between him, the host, and the viewer, whether it was a 5-year-old kid or a 50-year-old person who, you know, enjoyed what he was doing, was sacred, that there was a responsibility there to keep that space clean and clear for the people that are involved in what he was doing. And it doesn't take much to find, you know, 100 controversies that Alex Jones was part of, which riled people up, that may or may not have moved them to action in a negative way. And I'm going to leave it at that. But my point is there a responsibility? Do you feel a responsibility to hold the line to some degree as how you put this information out without having someone think that, you know, that they're going to go save the world because you told them so?
Do I feel a responsibility for that? No, not really. I mean, I feel a responsibility for not leaving my listeners blind at the end of the show. So one of the things I always took really careful care to do was to find the silver lining. I've talked about some tough topics over the years. I still talk about some tough topics. And like recently I produced a show about Jeffrey Epstein and that whole thing. And then, you know, there's 5G and there's lots of things coming up where people are very afraid and very worried. So I feel a responsibility in some sense to, well, let's look at that a little closer. Let me dig. Let me find somebody who can talk to that and see if I can produce a show that might be of interest and also help people get through some difficult information and find themselves on the other side, not depressed and ready to jump off a bridge.
Right, right.
So I always took the perspective that if I'm producing a show and I'm going on the radio and this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to make sure at the end of the show, my guest and I talk about how to overcome some of these stronger emotions that some of these topics provoked. And I hope I did a good job. I mean, I always got good feedback from people about that. So I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but
it does.
Responsibility I've always felt had to do with that mostly.
Right. My point is this. You could take, if you go on Facebook, and I had to actually stop doing this, the landfill of Facebook where everything gets recycled, whether it's true or not. And I actually, for about 2 months last year, I created a page called The Real News Network, you know, because I got nothing else to do. But the point was, the reason I did it is I was constantly seeing these articles or these videos or whatever you want to call it that would float up that were patently not true. I mean, there was no truth to them. They were totally fabricated memes, whatever. And people were putting them up without researching what they were, why they were. And then I'd watch 50 people argue about something that's not even true. So there was no responsibility factor in passing along information that wasn't accurate. But I guess my point with that was, you do a lot of digging behind the scenes, which allows you to have a great measure of responsibility for what you're putting out in the world. I guess that's where I was headed.
Okay. Well, that's true. And I saw that too. And what was happening with all the other hosts that would be considered alternative media hosts or networks, would just run with a story that was sent to them by some obscure source.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what started to happen, and I could be very right with this, is that we had information being infused because we had millions of listeners between all of us. There was a good handful of 10 or 20 people who were doing really solid shows and had real big followings, and I was one of those people. And so I knew about all the other ones, and we all knew about each other, and sometimes we'd interview each other, and sometimes we cooperated, and sometimes we didn't. But there would be an infusion of a story, for example, that would go in, and it would be some kind of, you know, surprise kind of thing, out of left field kind of thing. Suddenly it would just be copied word for word and spread out. And I called some people out on that, much to their dismay. And I said, you know, you're getting it from this is the source of this material. And the website is questionable. The poster is questionable. There is no real source link to it. And if you start to break this down and investigate sections of it, you can't find anything. So why is it now out through 15 or 20 of the most popular outlets? So I think at some point, you know, disinformation was being fueled and funneled into these outlets because they were becoming so popular. And what happens when you don't have massive control over popular outlets is that, you know, you don't have control over the content that they're talking about or the information they're giving out or the quote facts, right?
Right.
So disinformation was one of the easiest ways to prove the weaknesses of the channels and the connections and the outlets that were happening at the time. And unfortunately, it was right. I mean, there were some people who didn't do any fact checking. They didn't source their information.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't research, and they just took the easy way out, which is to trust the gossip.
Yeah, and I don't know that that's a good thing. You know, it's not a new thing. It's always kind of been around in some way, shape, or form. And I've always found that confirmation bias to most people is more important than the truth, but that's a whole different show. When I think about all the, and I just want to jump to the book now, because again, full disclosure, I had the honor of really helping to edit that book. And when I started reading through the transcripts from all those shows that you did, first of all, as a radio veteran myself, I was a little jealous. I'm like, hey, this is some serious work put in here. And I didn't hear that from a lot of other of your contemporaries in the digital platform. So that right there scored huge points with me. You're an incredibly good interviewer, and you have the ability to dig past the headlines to the lifelines. And I think that is so critically important. Not to mention the fact, as you said, that a lot of the stuff that you were talking about, you don't hear. First of all, you can't watch the news because it's really an infomercial for what? Drugs. The news is interspersed between drug commercials. You're not going to get it there. You listen to terrestrial radio. If by chance you hear it overnight somewhere, that might be part of it. But for the most part, this is information that most people don't have access to. And my thought was, when you put this book together, what a daunting task. All the people you've talked to, putting those all in one volume, how difficult was it for you to choose who to put in, who not to put in, and what was the real impetus for the impact to make it that way?
Well, it's a good question, and I have to acknowledge your help with the book, too, and thank you for writing the foreword. It was quite a task. It took me about a year to dig through all the shows and organize the files, because I have to admit I wasn't great at keeping track of a lot of it, so I had to rein it all in, organize it, and then I had to choose. So the reason how I chose these 20 conversations out of, a decade and a half of work was based on where I was at the moment the book was being written. So what was going on? Well, here I was. We had this really crazy election. Everybody was reacting to it. The political arena was shaken up a little bit or a lot. And here I was looking at content strangely being censored and being removed off of the internet. And I have watched the privacy laws change since 9/11. It's one of the things as a radio host that I've been doing. And I'll talk about it sometimes too. So it was starting to match the agendas of certain technologies that were rising up. And one of those is facial recognition technology. Mm-hmm. So I was really kind of absorbed into this topic because I was watching it happen. I was watching the nightly news turn into an infomercial for whatever the official story is, and drug companies, yes, because that's all the play is, really. So I felt like it was like, okay, so what are we all dealing with right now? Well, we're all dealing with this uprising, we're dealing with anger, we're dealing with not being able to control who we want as leadership, feeling duped, feeling hoodwinked. All these things were kind of circulating in the collective energies of especially our country at the time. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, what conversations could I pick out of all this content that would offer some kind of roadmap in through the consciousness that would connect dots that you normally wouldn't connect unless you're somebody like me who's dabbled and talked to experts and whistleblowers and all these people. I've done all the work for the readers, right? So right. Here you go. And if you read from and Barbara Hanclow was instrumental in helping me go through and arrange the order of the transcripts, because I had her read through the book or the chapter summaries at least, and she was, oh no, you want this one first. And so she kind of helped organize this according, because we had a couple conversations about what my intent was. So when the reader goes from chapter 1 to 20, they go through a series of individual shows, transcripts from the shows, and they get information, chapter 1, chapter 2, sure, and each chapter can stand on its own for content, as you know.
Right.
I also wanted these voices to be remembered as some of these visionary type people who have really done a lot of work in bringing to the table information that people really do need to maybe hear or learn or know more about. So depending on where everybody is on their own path, some people are very versed in these kind of topics, and some people are very new, or some people have never even been exposed to it.
Right.
So I wanted my book to be able to take those three types of people and make them happy by the time they were done with the book, as far as adventure goes, and it's deliberately laid out in the content the way it is from chapter 1 to 20 to take you through a very specific and deliberate journey through this kind of information. So I picked a lot of people who are very famous now. Some of them are on Ancient Aliens. Some of them have done a lot of great work. Some of them aren't alive anymore. I mean, so it's been, for me, it was like a legacy, not only of my work as a radio host. You know, my grandkids can someday pick this up and maybe know grandma a little better, right?
That's right.
But people can pick it up and they can know the time frame better.
Right.
So I know that some point down the road, someone is going to research these particular formative years, and they're going to find something very interesting. And I hope my book is kind of like a lighthouse for that. So it can never be changed. No publisher can ever take the information and censor it or move it around or republish it. That's why I published it myself, and I felt that it was the right thing to do. And it's like a time capsule.
Right.
Someday those conversations are going to be very important to somebody somewhere. I felt very, very called to do it. And I don't know what that future is, but I could feel that it was very important to take some of these conversations. And I hope some of my other colleagues do the same with their content, because they're facing the same censorship. They're facing the same removal. They're facing the same inability to reach people now because the reins are being pulled in on the internet. So I hope they all take their content and put it out in books. So people can read them and say, oh, back in 2008, this is, you know, when before the internet or the social media stuff started popping out, people weren't this.
Right.
Or they might have to read about time travel technology with Dr. David Lewis Anderson and data. So, I mean, some of it might feel far-fetched for people. But I said, this is what I say to them. I said, well, you know, it was far-fetched when someone announced that the world was round instead of flat, right? It was far-fetched when a lot of people would come out with these theories that sounded so science fiction, but yet turned out to be true. Time moved on, and we were able to bring that to the surface. So I hope at some point my book becomes a marker for content and information that was coming out of the mouths of some of the most monumental people that were being interviewed at the time. And it opens people's eyes and their hearts and their minds to the fact that what we're in right now is the box. We've all been put into a box, and we're told we're either right or left, and I keep reminding people there's a middle.
That's right. And it's not political. It has nothing to do with that. That does break down on those different things, but I tell people all the time when I go out and give talks, and I did a TED talk in Ontario a couple of years ago called Human Math, based on not the life expectancy you have from the year that you were born, but the fact of the matter is that there's no guarantee you're going to ever get to that life expectancy, which at the time was like 77 and a half years that you get a chance to be around, which is about 28,000 days. And that all the years that I've been alive, and unfortunately all the funerals that I've been to, I've never seen Republican or Democrat or independent on a headstone ever. And we spend so much of our life apart from each other based on these downloads that we're told this and we're told that, and this is who you are. And I've also spent time with people who have had to undo what's been done to them on many different levels with who they thought they were and those kind of things. So it's quite a deal to be here on the planet at this particular time. Every generation has its challenges and changes. I just don't think there's ever been a time we've had so much and knew so little about ourselves. And so wrapping this up, this information concept, and you and I could talk for about 5 hours. We used a whole week worth of shows with Hillary Ramo, because this is just literally, well, seriously, it's the tip of the iceberg. And this is why you're so good at what you do. And I was so honored to write the foreword to your book. We're going to put the link up there on the Life 2.0 page. You can click through and get the book. It's fantastic. And you know, look, I'm pretty hardcore on a lot of different things and hardlined and been in the media a long time and all the media wars and all that kind of stuff. So I get pretty jaded. But when I found myself going through the stories in the book and the conversations going, that's a good thing. If you could crack this shell, if you can crack this shell, then you're doing the right thing. But getting down to the whole concept here of reining in the internet and all that kind of stuff, and you know, I feel like in some ways we're just teenagers on the planet. We're the youngest species in the world. One of the things you and I also share in common is our concern for the environment. And I don't mean the environment outside of us, but the environment that encapsulates us, that we depend on for our lives. And when it comes to that, we are the youngest species. We're like teenagers. We don't know what we're doing. You know, we never clean up our room. We shit on the floor, forget it's there, and slip in it. And this information, we have more at our fingertips than any other group of humans have ever had in the history of the world. I have more technology in this outdated Samsung J3 phone that I have literally taped to a insert so I can use it through the Zoom machine so we can have this conversation. That's the, they didn't have that on the lunar module, right? So we have all this technology that seems to be, as Bucky Fuller said, our friend, surpassing our humanity. How do we come to grips with that? That's a huge task for us as humans.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the difference between our generation and the younger generations growing up, you know, we still remember what it was like to not have the technology. And most of us had childhoods that we spent outside. We had imagination at play. You know, there was a different childhood. Now we have the younger generations growing up with the devices. Parents are taking pictures of them and putting it all over social media. This also brings up the question of permission, like how much do you put your child out there? And then we have kids who use the technology. You know, they have cell phones by the time they're in first or second grade. Sometimes parents wait till middle school. I mean, everybody's got different rules with that. But the younger and younger and younger exposure to technology, the internet, screen time, all of that has been studied and talked about quite a bit, actually, which is good because we should be having these conversations. And it's been proven that a lot of things like attention deficiency disorder, a lot of things along those lines can be cued on in a person because of their lack of time in nature and all that. And I think we have to send our kids back outside to ride bikes and play in the woods and play in mud puddles and get dirty and come inside for dinner and have dinner in the family. I mean, some of the basic values that I grew up with are missing in households, I've noticed. And I think that has an important part to play in it as well. The digital age offers us a lot of innovation, a lot of possibilities that are good. So it's a double-edged sword. And, you know, you have a whole, it just opens you up to an entire different universe or reality. And we have to be careful not to claim our identity solely based on that reality. We have to remember that reality is wherever we are at any given moment, and consciousness follows suit. So if we're sitting in our house for 8 hours a day attached to a computer because that's our work and that's what we do, then it's very easy to become digitalized identity. You know, you become an identity that's connected and associated with your screen time. And then when you turn it off, you're like, oh, whoa, it's a little disoriented for a little while.
Right.
But I think people are realizing as we grow up in this quickly that we have to be very mindful in this digital age. If we're not mindful in the digital age, then what happens is we become very addicted to it and we think things are what they aren't and things become very disillusioned and can be a very sad story. So we have to remind ourselves not to do it. I think that's the best, is living by example. And if you're a parent, please consider not giving your kid a cell phone until they're like, you know, way out of high school. I don't know. I don't know what the right age is.
Well, yeah,
but
I think we're past that.
I mean, you
I agree.
I think we are. Yeah. And I think people go to school and their friends have what they have. And it's just like when they had the coolest toy and they bring it in, we all want it. We all want to go home and beg mom and dad to get it for us. Right.
Right.
So I think we just have to, as a whole, we have to support each other in the realness of each other. You know, if somebody's like, if I'm doing an art show, don't just like it on Facebook, show up, you know, come and see it. Come and see it in that way. Be a human about it and come see me face to face or give me a call and talk about it. I think likes are becoming an easy way to give people a little shortened zap of attention. And lots of studies have proven that social media is becoming really something they have to get a handle on before it takes over and makes people really literally insane.
I agree with you. And listen, you know, the thing about it is the human mind has a real difficult time discerning what reality is. And that's just a tool or a measurement, a way that, as you said, it's all kind of subjective. It's not very objective. It's subjective. I mean, when I was 10 years old, I thought Night of the Living Dead really happened in Pittsburgh. It took about 2 years to figure out it's just a movie. And so when it takes this information in, and by the way, to this day, I don't want to watch it. There's no way. it's just too scary. And And yet, because of this, when you think the input that technology has on young minds that aren't fully formed and don't have their firewall up yet, that they don't really know who they are, and so this information gets in, I find it fascinating and debilitating at the same time that you could, like, here's the thing for me. As a veteran myself, I have a hard time with any game that depicts war. I don't get it. And when I found out there's, you know, video games for Pearl Harbor, World War II, Call of Duty, my old school mindset is, you want Call of Duty? Go to the goddamn recruiter, sign up. We'll get you Call of Duty, like my, you know, nephew did in the Marines recently. You want Call of Duty, you want action, go do that. But the human mind allows some kid who's 20, 21, 22, 18, 19, whatever, to sit in their basement and become that, which they really aren't, except for that video screen where they be this emoji or this meme or whatever you want to call it. I don't even know what you call these figures. And the mind thinks they're really doing these things, which makes two things happen, in my opinion. One is, it makes you think you're more than you are, because outside of the basement, it doesn't mean shit. And second, it makes it really difficult to move in a world that's not set up this way. So part of it is, it's great to have all these cool technologies. And I guess, you know, this is a bit of an old school way to look at it, but I actually wrote a letter a couple years ago to one of the game manufacturers that makes $1 billion a year selling this stuff. And I said, hey, if you're going to have games based on war, then you should also, you know, include like the PTSD part. Let the kids have to go through PTSD if they're playing these games, not just get blown up and start over again. And number two, if you just donate 0.5% of your profits to helping veterans that are in difficulty, I think we'd all get along better. You know the answer? Thanks for your input. So for me, when I come across these things where technology and humanity intersect and I don't see it helping humanity, I guess I have a really hard time. That's why I asked you on to help me see some of the benefits in places that I can't.
Well, video games are really interesting because not only does it change your biological chemistry when you're in a situation, because the brain doesn't really know the difference between you playing,
right. Kill
somebody in real time versus killing somebody in real time, right? You're still getting the same kind of adrenaline rush, and there's a lot of really interesting science to it. But you're right on when you say a kid will get off the game and then he goes out into a world that's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So what does it do? And some of these kids are on these games a lot. Mm-hmm. So if they're on it a lot, their brain is changing according to that screen time and that live interactive. And it's becoming a big social thing for teenagers and people because they can get on with their friends.
Sure.
They can all play in their own houses. They don't have to actually get together and see each other. And some of the young people that I've spoken to about that actually really don't like that part of it. It's that, like, their friends don't literally get together anymore because they just get online and play Call of Duty or Modern Warfare or some game that's really set up. And I think that, you know, when we talk about school shootings and we talk about some of the bigger violence-related things that we see going on in the world, we have to remember, well, it's not all about video games, but it has to be considered because our younger generations are growing up hardwired for not only technology, but for playing and being social in that violent kind of situation.
Yep.
So they're all working as a military team, going through some village and picking off people that are playing on other ends of the world. And they're desensitized to the violence and to killing. And what does that do to empathy? And what does that do to consciousness? And what does that do to compassion? Well, I think it kind of overrides it. And over time, the more and more you do that, you become calloused to a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have to talk about that and have those conversations and be real and maybe even interview our younger kids that are really stuck in it and they don't know how to get out of it because they don't know anything else. And parents really love babysitters. So
yeah,
technical stuff can be babysitters sometimes, just like the TV.
Yep.
So it's a group effort and it takes a village to raise people correctly. And I think that we're losing that connection as we find, quote, connection online.
Agreed. Listen, you're really smart. So thanks for spending time with us today. There are some things that are concepts that are beyond my comprehension. And whenever you post something on Facebook or I get a chance to look between the covers of one of your books or your artwork, which is just incredible, and traveling the world and having these art shows and all these, you know, it's like you know, you're like a Renaissance woman to me. You do all these things so well. It's why I asked you in the beginning where this all comes from, because you're able somehow to take a lot of these platforms and these talents that you have and pull them together. They're all kind of connected. Do you ever see the art, the books, the radio? Do you see it all as a mosaic in your life?
Yeah, I think they're all related, because for every, that's a common thing I get. You do too much. I said, no, I don't do too much. I just do everything that I want to do. Yeah. So the artwork for me is a way to actualize and manifest beauty in a world that really needs to be reminded of it. So it's my focus now, and it's been for a few years, but so is radio, because producing a productive show is like an act of beauty, and writing a book that's important or makes people think, for me, is an act of beauty. So my spiritual upbringing helped me to see early on what is an act of beauty and what is manifestation, and how do you focus and ground yourself, and how do you meditate. So I took all of that and I moved it into my adult world, and I find that it works really well. So I'm always doing something, but I'm always doing it with a bigger purpose in mind. And that always has to do with beauty and love and kindness and trying to bring people together. I hope that comes across. So.
No doubt. Last question. I ask everybody this, and I don't ever tell anybody I'm going to ask him this, because then it'd be like for the whole hour going, what's the answer? But when you look across the spectrum of your life, and not as a career, but as a calling, what's the big aha for you? What is the thing that you come away with at the end of the day when all these parts are moving in and out of your life and you know the path that you've been on and the journey that you continue on? What's the big aha or takeaway for you?
Oh, well, you know, the big aha for me is that, because, you know, I'm human and I have some days where I lose my motivation and I have to find it. So when I'm searching for motivation, it really helps for me to remember that there are good people in the world. There are good things in the world, and my assumptions or my judgments might be wrong. So I try to remember that when I go out into the world, whether it's to work or to play or to just go grocery shopping, even smiling at people, even having these tiny little moments, and remembering that even when you're in a lot of pain, you can still find a way to pray. You can still find a way to connect to whatever higher power you believe in. And it's okay for everyone to do that in their own way. So my aha moment was that, well, yeah, I might have my own way of doing things, but there's other people that have their own way of doing things too. And it's really nice to meet them and have conversations with them. So I try not to get too bogged down in negativity. I guess that's why I can go into topics that are a little harder. I know a lot of spiritual people who will not talk about certain topics, and I just look at them kind of funny, and I'm like, why? We actually need your spiritual experience brought into some of these harder topics, and we need your light to be able to explain it and dissect it for people who are struggling. So my aha moment was always that, well, you know, I guess not everybody can walk into that dark stuff and be able to talk about it and bring light to it. So I realized that I am able to do that, and so that's part of my purpose.
Listen, you know, artist, radio host, writer, those are just labels on a file drawer somewhere. You are so much more than that. I've always been appreciative and have a great respect for our friendships, personally and professionally. You do a great job of the world. I know the world's a better place because you're doing all the things that are part of your mosaic. And I'm going to make sure that obviously people be able to click on the link, which is on the Podbean page, Life 2.0 page. This is even... for me, a new deal. I started radio with a telephone upside down because there was no Gettner machine talking to people for an hour a week. And now here I am 23 years later, thousands of shows, you know, all the awards, all that kind of stuff, which is just a byproduct of the effort. I've often faltered but never wavered. Let me put it that way. And I think I see the similar thing in you. You find your way through these nooks and crannies, these speed bumps, these ups and downs, whatever the platform is that calls to you. You're able to display your talents there, so I really appreciate it.
Well, John, I have to say thanks for always being an encouraging person. And, you know, ever since I brought you on the air early on in my career, I have always appreciated your perspective and your advice. So I want to say thank you to you, too. And thanks for bringing me on to your show and being able to have this conversation with your listeners. It means a lot.